anytime that a national organization or figure highlights our campaign and endorses it, that's always brings the outside media.
Murkowski's Republican challenger wins a big endorsement. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 16th of June. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, criticism for the critical habitat plan for the polar bear.
We'll suffer the negative impacts of this designation while it helps the polar bear not at all.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alaska State Elks Association, offering the Alaska State Elks Camp in the Matanuska Valley, available for weddings, parties, reunions, and other public or private meetings. Information at alaskastateelks.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The National Tea Party movement has endorsed Lisa Murkowski's opponent in the Republican Senate primary. Fairbanks lawyer Joe Miller got the endorsement today. The Tea Party's political director Brian Schroyer released a statement today calling Murkowski, quote, part of the problem in Washington. Joe Miller says the endorsement is a big boost to his campaign.
The Tea Party movement embodies the ideals that really gave me the reason to run, and that's the belief that government's growing too large. It's my perspective that Murkowski has been part of that problem, and my commitment is to be part of the solution in helping return our nation to limited constitutional government.
The Tea Party Express is pledging to help with funding and commercials. It also brings national attention to Miller's candidacy. He's only run for office once before when he lost a Fairbanks State House race. Senator Lisa Murkowski's campaign spokesman Steve Wachowski says the incumbent has fought Democrats in the Senate and the Obama White House, including their support of health care legislation. He pointed to other credentials typically seen as conservative, including an A rating from the National Rifle Association and her opposition to raising the debt limit.
This race is about who's in the best position to stand up to the Obama administration and fight the federal government's encroachment into the lives of Alaskans. And, you know, we know what Lisa's been doing for us, fighting since day one. And I think her credentials as a conservative are clear. She's opposed the Democrat stimulus bill and voted 9 times to repeal parts and the entirety of Obamacare. And as an example, just last week, she led the fight to curtail the massive government encroachment into our economy. As you know, the EPA power grab on carbon emissions, and it even generated a veto threat from President Obama.
The Tea Party movement carried influence in other recent Republican primary battles. In Nevada, it helped Senate candidate Sharon Angle defeat a better-known Republican, pouring $500,000 into her campaign, and it helped beat incumbent Republican Senator Bob Bennett of Utah. A public hearing in Anchorage last night on proposed critical habitat for the polar bear didn't draw a big crowd, but it did set up a passionate debate on how much critical habitat the species needs. It also raised the question of whether setting aside the land and sea acreage will really make a difference for the polar bear's survival. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wants to designate 187,000 square miles for polar bear critical habitat, an area larger than the state of California, as several people at the hearing pointed out. It's mostly sea ice habitat off Alaska's coast in the Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas, but it also includes barrier islands and onshore denning habitat along a long stretch of the state's north and west coast. Fish and Wildlife Service says the critical habitat designation will have minimal impacts on industry in the area because there are already strict protections for the species. For Richard Glenn of the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, that begged a question.
If the creation of critical habitat's not going to result in any additional protection for the polar bear, then why create it? And especially, why establish such a broad, sweeping area of its range for critical habitat? To me, it's like using a fire hose when maybe you might need a water pick.
The critical habitat proposal includes land surrounding Barrow and lands owned by the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. Glenn worries that will slow economic development in the area. He says the polar bear's survival depends on something a critical habitat designation can't provide.
Nothing is going to create more ice. We can establish that. And so if you remove the economy for our region, you remove the ability for our people to better themselves, we'll suffer the negative impacts of this designation while it helps the polar bear not at all.
The state of Alaska's endangered species coordinator echoed Glenn's concerns at the hearing, along with industry representatives. The proposal estimates the habitat designation will cost industry less than $2,000 extra for each project in the area. Carl Portman with the Resource Development Council says that figure grossly underestimates the real economic impact.
Environmental groups will litigate virtually every industry project within or adjacent to critical habitat, putting them and their associated benefits to local communities, the state, and the nation at risk, and at the very least resulting in costly delays and modifications.
But environmental groups defended the scope of the critical habitat plan. Carla Dutton is Alaska Director for Defenders of Wildlife. She says designating critical habitat doesn't put a halt to development.
We feel that while it looks large and onerous to industry and the state of Alaska, it actually makes sense because they have laid out places where polar bears need to be. And when you have critical habitat designations, it doesn't put a fence around those areas and close them off.
And the Center for Biological Diversity doesn't think the proposal goes far enough. They've asked the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to include more denning habitat on land and even underwater habitat in the plan. Rebecca Noblin spoke on behalf of the group. She says the proposal should also consider climate change and accuse the agency of having a head-in-the-sand approach to the issue.
As agency charged with protecting polar bears, it is the service's responsibility to do everything possible to ensure that polar bears survive and thrive in the coming century. If we do not address greenhouse gas emissions, the polar bear faces certain extinction, very likely well within this century.
The polar bear was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in May of 2008, and critical habitat must be designated under that law. The Fish and Wildlife Service will take more public comment in Barrow tomorrow. The written comment period is open until July 6th. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission earlier this week gave the nod to the Denali Natural Gas Pipeline Project's open season plan. The panel's decision opens the way for backers of the joint BP-Conoco project to begin soliciting interest from shippers. A joint House and Senate Finance Committee hearing today on the plan allowed Denali President Bud Fackrell to update state legislators on what's in store for the project.
We will start our open season here in just a few weeks on July 6th, and we'll complete the open season on October 4th. So that's the 90-day actual open season period. During open season, we will be seeking binding agreements. To move a pipeline forward, particularly one of this size, we need firm transportation commitments, and that starts with precedent agreements being signed during the open season.
The Denali Pipeline Project competes with a similar project headed by TransCanada Corporation to bring North Slope natural gas to lower 48 markets. TransCanada has a special license with the state under the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. The Denali Project has no state incentives, but Fackrell told the legislators that global engineers such as Bechtel and CH2M Hill are partnering on the project. He said that $100 million has been spent on studies, and he is confident that there is adequate data to provide potential shippers with firm cost information.
So in the end, we're very confident that we have a high-quality design. And that's important because one of the things we're trying to do is convince shippers that we know what the cost of the pipeline is today and then what the risks and uncertainties are of that pipeline.
The Denali project is estimated to cost $35 billion. Some legislators were concerned that BP's current oil spill crisis in the Gulf of Mexico would drain capital from the Denali project. Fackrell said that is not the case.
We have a budget that's been approved by both of our owners, and they've indicated to me that they will support that. So we feel good about moving through open season with the budget and funding that we have today.
The open season is a 90-day period in which Denali officials attempt to get binding signatures from companies interested in shipping the gas. Fackrell said the pipeline is expected to carry 4.5 billion cubic feet of gas a day from the North Slope to offtake points in Alberta. The Denali gas pipeline, if built, will be operable by 2020. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, outrage in Juneau over a proposed electricity rate increase.
Will the last resident of Juneau on his or her way out of town please turn the lights off?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you've been through a lot of bad things and you feel like everyone would be better off without you, suicide isn't the answer. You're not alone. You have people who love you, and there is help. Call the Alaska Care Line at 1-877-266-HELP. Call, share, and live. If you're thinking about suicide, call for help at 1-877-266-HELP. This message sponsored by the Mindy Schloss Memorial Fund and the State of Alaska.
Electricity rates in the capital city could jump 24%. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska is considering an Alaska Electric Light and Power proposal to permanently raise rates about 2 cents a kilowatt hour. The RCA could take up to 15 months to decide, so in the interim, the utility company is asking for a 20% hike. As KTOO's Rosemary Alexander reports, regulatory commissioners held a consumer input hearing in Juneau last night and got an earful.
We are being fleeced under the guise of genuine economics.
This was a hearing just for customers, and those testifying agreed the large rate hike would hurt just about everyone in town, from senior citizens to local government. But AEL&P President Tim McLeod told the crowd the 24% rate increase is less than the company needs.
To help minimize the requested rate increase, AEL&P has asked for approval of only 2/3 of the rate increase that its study indicates is required to cover all of AEL&P's annual cost of providing service.
The privately owned utility company has increased its rates twice since 1996, each time less than 5%. But this year, the new Lake Dorothy Hydroelectric Project is online, and AEL&P must cover its investment. Though many of those testifying said they weren't there to bash the utility, they wondered how it could justify a 24% permanent increase, let alone the 20% interim rate.
Any 20% increase on a necessary utility is unreasonable, regardless of the reason.
The increase would be applied to energy usage. The monthly customer charge would remain the same. Current residential peak season rates, November through May, are just under 10 cents a kilowatt hour. That would increase to nearly 12 cents a kilowatt, still one of the lowest rates in the state. If the average customer uses 750 kilowatts a month, as the company claims, the average peak season bill would go up $17 a month. The increase would affect commercial users, too. Most of them have already budgeted their utility costs for the year, but may have to plan for thousands more for electricity. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, has 5 sites in Juneau. Al Nelson is facilities manager.
At the huge rate increase being discussed, we would incur between $20,000 and $30,000 in electrical costs, depending on the severity of the winter.
Laura Lynn Swanson manages Fireweed Place, a senior citizen apartment building downtown. She estimates electricity costs would go up $18,000 a year for the common areas of the building.
Tenants will receive a double hit in that their individual apartment rates will go up as well.
And Swanson says the increase could force Fireweed to raise the senior citizens' rent. In its deliberation, the 5-member regulatory commission will consider the ratepayers' testimony, as well as the more than 100 comments left on the RCA website. Some at the hearing had a message for the RCA.
I'm an old lady, but I represent a lot of people, and we don't know where we're going to get the money to pay for such an increase.
If the 25% increase will be approved by you people, then please, will the last resident of Juneau on his or her way out of town, please turn the lights off. Thank you for listening.
The Regulatory Commission is expected to make a decision tomorrow to continue studying AEL&P's permanent rate increase, as well as the 20% interim request. Customers would begin seeing that charge in this month's bills. In Juneau, I'm Rose Marie Alexander.
See, Alaska's controversial land selection bill could undergo major changes soon. Amendments circulating among interest groups suggest shifts in selected timberlands and future economic development sites, but nothing's finalized. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski is expected to revise her See Alaska Lands bill within a few weeks, and groups involved in the legislation have gotten advance notice of some of the changes under consideration. Proposed amendments include a shuffle in some of the Tongass National Forest land See Alaska could select for logging. Rick Harris is the Southeast Regional Native Corporation's executive vice president.
The economic development lands, or the timberlands, are still pretty much the areas that we defined in the original legislation. However, they've been adjusted or moved around in a way to try to avoid or minimize conflicts.
Northern Prince of Wales Island selections would be cut to address some objections from Point Baker, Port Protection, and Edna Bay. The change would also leave Tongass timber that the region's mills hope to harvest and process. Replacement timberlands would be added on Tuxican and QU Islands, west and north of Prince of Wales. Other additions would be made elsewhere on Prince of Wales. Amendments would also create fishery conservation areas within the Tongass, where commercial logging would be prohibited. Jaylene Kukesh-Arujo is Sea Alaska's general counsel.
So we're taking them out of our selection pool to put them in a different status because they were, we were told that they were very important to certain fisheries users.
Sea Alaska says the idea came from Murkowski's office. The proposed amendments also remove about 20 native futures sites to answer objections mostly from nearby communities. About 30 would remain. The sites are small areas set aside for ecotourism, energy development, and other enterprises. Other changes would address access issues and eliminate sacred site selections within Glacier Bay. Congressional staffers would not discuss specific amendments since Murkowski has not approved them. The bill is in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Sea Alaska CEO Chris McNeil says many changes are still being discussed.
I think the intent of the parties is to diminish the amount of conflict related to the selections. And I'll be very surprised if once the committee publishes something that there will be more conflict rather than less conflict.
The bill doesn't go far enough in addressing community concerns about subsistence resources and existing rural businesses.
Lindsay Ketchell is executive director of the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council.
In general, we feel that the bill is still missing opportunities to move the region forward around a common vision for vibrant communities and a sustainable forest industry.
She says the proposed habitat protections do not go far enough. That includes the fishery conservation areas, which SEAC considers to be a token offering. Sea Alaska could select its remaining Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act acreage without the bill, but it would be restricted to land the corporation says should be protected, such as subsistence hunting areas and community watersheds. Legislation is needed to allow selections outside those areas. The bill is not expected to move on its own. Backers and opponents say it will most likely be added to a larger piece of land-related legislation. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
Fishing for king salmon has returned to the Kenai River, and standard regulations returned to the Kasilof River on Thursday, lifting restrictions that were in place. But sport fishing guides in the area say even the few days of a closure hurt their businesses. KDLL's Ben Stanton reports.
First, Fish and Game closed king salmon fishing on the Kenai River about a week ago. Then last weekend, they allowed some catch and release, and now the department is opening it further. It allows for the harvest of fish other than those between 46 and 55 inches long. Area sport fish management biologist for Fish and Game in Soldotna, Robert Begich, says the reason for the initial closure was simple.
Projections of run strength indicated that the total run would be lower than our lower escapement go bound of 5,300.
Now the escapement numbers have increased, but some local sport fishing guides report previous reservation cancellations even before the catch and release was lifted. Here's how Kenai River Professional Guide Association President Dave Goja described it.
You know, the damage is pretty much done already. Our clients have already canceled.
And after the restriction was lifted, Kenai River Sport Fishing Association Executive Director Ricky Geese says he agrees with Goja that the sentiment among Central Peninsula sport fishers are that people change their plans to fish. And as with most fishing in Alaska, people disagree about management practices. Geese thinks the initial shutdown last week was premature.
And that decision cost this community recreational values that are associated with people going out and being able to fish, and economic values that are associated with people, you know, who travel here and visit here and go fishing here.
Geese also says there should have been more public outreach to indicate that a shutdown was possible. Begich says the department has several tools, among them the preseason outlook for early and late run king salmon, which was below average, and to monitor fish, Fish and Game uses sonar, creel survey, and test netting.
We use all those tools to do daily projections of the run real time, so management decisions are made pretty much daily.
Begich says adding restrictions to a fishery usually takes more lead time than liberalization. He also says that because Alaska's salmon management is based on abundance, it can only deal with projections that have levels of uncertainty. Taking a step up or down with the restrictions is made with the end escapement projection in mind. That's based on the best information at the time, according to Begich. Although Geese disagrees with the previous decisions, he says there is room for optimism.
It was a late run that came into the river, and it's good that we're on track to meet our escapement goals, and it's good that we're back to retention of fish in the river. The community didn't have to get waylaid in the controversy. Fish and Game had the tools in the toolbox via the management plans to step down just so that we avoid these controversial decisions like that.
And Begich also says this month has a good chance to look good. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
A transformation is quietly taking place in rural Alaska and at Anchorage's Native Medical Campus. More and more of the health professionals are Alaska Native. For our series on Alaska Native education, KSKA's Len Anderson talked to one of the earliest, Ted Mala, who heads the Traditional Healing Clinic and Tribal Affairs Office at South Central Foundation in Anchorage.
Dr. Ted Mala quickly points out that despite several biographies on the internet, he is not the first Alaska Native medical doctor. That distinction belongs to Loretta Snyder, originally from Nome. But unlike Mala, she never came back to Alaska, leaving Mala a different first.
Much to my surprise, when I was doing my training at Old Native Hospital in 1975, to find out that I was the first male and the first one really to come home. So that was a surprise. And nothing's planned. You're just thrown into the gene pool and somehow twirled around, and you come out the other end not knowing what to expect, and that's what happened to me.
Mala's belief in happenstance started early with a series of abrupt, unforeseen changes to his life. His father, Ray Mala, was the first Native American Hollywood movie star. His mother was Russian, who in 1917 escaped the Bolshevik Revolution to save her life. When he was very young, the family traveled between California and Buckland, his father's Northwest Alaska home village. When Ted was six, his father died of mitral valve heart disease. His mother died a year later.
All of a sudden, I had no parents. I was out of boarding school and didn't really have anyone to look up to other than relatives that were very far away.
The boarding school was a Catholic military California facility run by direct from Ireland nuns. Despite his discomfort, Mala says he received a good education. Orderly work in a hospital led to a brief stint in nursing education, which transformed into medical school and a degree from Harvard. Back in Alaska, his curiosity about his mother's Russian homeland increased. That evolved into a medical interest in Northern Circumpolar Health.
When I was the director of the Institute for Circumpolar Health, which I started many years ago, I went around to the northern countries and lived and worked in Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Greenland, Norway, Canada, Russia, and of course Alaska.
Mala's group had to figure out a common approach to northern health concerns that crossed international boundaries.
The North was divided into four categories of people. One was native peoples, indigenous peoples. Second was what we called short-term residents, people had just come to Alaska or to the North for a period maybe of under 7 years. Then we had long-term residents and we had transient workers.
The Circumpolar Health Association then delved into various conditions affecting the four groups. They studied diseases, of course, but also the effect of no light, too much light, personal relationships, and even medical personnel situations unique to the far north. During some of that time, Mala also served as Commissioner of Health and Human Services during Wally Hickel's second term as governor. If his father's condition and death nudged Mala toward becoming a medical doctor, his family history of native healers in the Kotzebue-Buckland area led him to the directorship of South Central Foundation's Traditional Healing Clinic. It's the totality of the native healing process that captures Mala's enthusiasm.
You can't deny that the experience of these people sustained people way before any of these new technological wonders came about. And so there's a lot of knowledge and a lot of wisdom in there that treats not only the physical, but the spiritual, the mental, and the emotional. It treats the whole person, not just part of the person.
Patients at the Alaska Native Health Center can only go to the traditional healers if referred by their Western-trained doctors. As he did earlier between northern countries, Mala, with his own MD, is bridging the Western and traditional medical approaches. Mala sees his next task as another bridge, this time between his generation of doctors and healers and the young Alaska Natives just now choosing their life work. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rosemarie Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ben Stanton in Kenai, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF Fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.